Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, with me is Michael, and from beautiful uptown Chicago, this is Double Feature. We have two films today.
We're going to cover M and 7 in the single character edition.
Yeah, so this is another one of these, like, we always have two themes, right?
Yeah.
We have the, like, well-thought-out, you know, philosophical binding theme of the two things.
And then the
things.
Men in gray suits theme.
Yeah, and then there's the, like, bullshit accidental theme that always seems to crop up. I don't know how that keeps happening. This is sort of in the same way that we did Behind the Mask and Black Christmas. This is kind of the beginning and end of film noir, you know, to some extent. I think we're looking at much more extreme ends here. We are going to spoil both of these films.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much on M, a little bit on it. Yeah, we're going to talk about the end at great length. So,
we're going to spoil everything.
Seven, I think, is the kind of movie that if you talk about any of it, you're in big spoiler territory.
Yeah.
We're definitely going to discuss the ending of that thing. We have chapters in the show. So what you can do is go to the chapter menu and skip the rest of this intro you've heard 1,000 times and go directly to M, which is the first film. So we need to take a pause and have a brief skeptic moment before we even talk about Fritz Lang's M. In this film, one of the ways that they try to track down the killer here is through graphology. It's the it's handwriting analysis, essentially. It's the idea that you can determine someone's physical characteristics or personality characteristics, more specifically, by looking at their handwriting.
That is total bullshit.
I'm actually going to give the film a pass at that one because they also talk about the unreliability of, you know, first-person eyewitness testimony directly after that. So it gets one right, too. And it's from the 30s, so it's okay. 1931, this is Fritz Lang's M. Also did Metropolis, which has been in my must-watch queue for like 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I still have that sitting on the shelf there. It's a German film. I know we kind of glossed over that last time. I think M was really influential to a lot of film noir, although I don't know if you would consider it film noir itself.
I wouldn't, but I mean, I don't really know anything about film noir.
You listen to this show. That's all you need to know.
I speak on this show.
You basically need this show and Wikipedia, and that's...
I have both of those.
Okay, well, there you go. You're now a film noir expert. There's a lot of different components that go into this film that, much like when we watched Black Christmas, that films later were inspired by, picked up, and a lot of things that they just left behind. So before we really get into the meat of a lot of the plot points in this film, I kind of wanted to figure out if a lot of the stuff that was left behind for a good reason, or if a lot of that stuff is missed.
Kind of like Black Christmas.
Why did slasher films
pick up what they did and ignore what they did?
I mean, the thing that separates this the most from the typical film noir we've been seeing is that it's not a hard-boiled detective novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? This isn't The Singing Detective. We don't have a gumshoe protagonist. We don't have a detective agency struggling to pay its rent where the male lead is flirting with his secretary all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of weird. We don't really have any protagonist at all. The one thing we do kind of get is the beginning of this low key lighting here.
Yeah.
Film noir ended up going really crazy with its lighting when it, you know, started doing all the stuff with the blinds, and here we just see really early beginnings of that. More the shadows, and you know, I think it's specifically that first scene, which is probably the more iconic piece of this, where it's the balls bouncing and it shows, you know, his shadow on the wanted poster, kind of establishes him as a character for the first time. Where I think you could see a more direct influence is, you know, even in stuff we've done on the show, like Silence of the Lambs.
Sure.
You know,
totally.
where you have a movie that's built around a killer, but when you're actually watching the movie, the pacing is such that you're really not with the killer that much. I think here, all of your protagonists, if there are any, are criminals. So you do have that crime element. And as far as crime movies go, I mean, 1931, this has to be like one of the first crime movies that at least had sound.
Yeah.
You know? I think the decision to have all criminal protagonists, or let's just say no protagonists. I mean,
I don't really think that's the thing.
That was the most interesting to me, is that where are the heroes in this film?
Honestly, I don't think there is one, because right about the time, you know, the planets align for the protagonist to really shine through, they just falter.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like, wait, you're not a good guy either.
Well, and the other thing about that, so the sort of the antagonist to the antagonist here, if we're going to consider Peter Lorre's character as the killer, as let's just call him the antagonist because he's doing bad things, even though he's the only one we're clearly following as a protagonist. It's getting very confusing. So the people trying to hunt him down, he's been accused of murdering these children, and the people trying to hunt him down, it's essentially the entire town. I mean, it's a mob, which we really end up seeing at the end of the film. But even if we consider the mob our protagonists, the fact that the people who end up hunting him down at the end are the crime syndicates, which, I mean, how good is that?
They're like, he's given us a bad rap. We need to take him out.
Right. Well, yeah, and the way they do it. My favorite thing about M, and the reason, the point I decided this is a keeper, it's the first time I'm watching it, and they go through what is literally like a 20-minute scene of them all sitting around going, well, what the fuck do we do about this guy? And so what's the conclusion they reach? Who do they employ?
It's the homeless.
Yeah, they...
The blind with label.
Yeah, they end up going through the town and telling all the homeless that they need to help with the situation. They employ the homeless. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. I absolutely love that whole element of it. But even, okay, so now we have this crime syndicate, we have the police, we have the people of the town, the concerned parents, and the homeless all tracking down Peter Lorre's character. But we don't know who any of these people are. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I don't even think we get very many names.
Nobody really has a big part in this. Peter Lorre, I know, because he went on to do, like, what was that? Crime and Punishment.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was... Actually, he did such a good job as this villain that he was typecast for fucking ever after doing this. Which maybe we'll see again with Morgan Freeman in another film coming up. But what do you think the pros and cons are of having a film where there are no clear lead characters for you to follow? How does that affect your viewing differently?
Well, there's definitely the major con of not really knowing where your allegiance lies. Because right. There's really no narrator. Right. I mean, there's...
Well, do you ever question that you should be against the killer, though?
Well, no. Like, the thing is, you never question it until it gets brought into question. Like, right. there's the whole scene at the end, and during that scene is when you finally go, well, maybe... he's crazy.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, that would probably fall into the pros because it sure. makes you question it just by not knowing where your allegiance is. Like, because normally when you have a protagonist or even an antagonist, like, clearly defined, if it's a protagonist, when they say something, you know, okay, that's how I'm supposed to feel.
But that's
even
what you're supposed to believe.
Even if that's
film.
Not personally how you believe, you know what the film wants you to believe.
Yeah.
And if it's the antagonist, you just go, okay, that guy's doing the opposite of what I should be thinking.
So if you follow the mob and you decide that you're going to align yourself with this mob, because I think that's one of the things that having no lead does do, is that you're part of the mob. Mm-hmm. You're not really following any leader. You're just kind of going along with the townspeople. Like, you want to catch the killer too.
Yeah.
It's better for the immersion. Where I wonder if that technique doesn't work is, you know, do you stumble through this thing at all? Because every time I watch it, I feel like... there's a little bit where I don't have a clear path of where I'm going or what I'm doing.
Totally. Well, because I
can't track the steps. I don't have two gumshoes on the case.
Yeah.
You know what
well,
I mean?
Yeah, you're not really sure. Well, one big problem I have is the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not sure how long of a time period this whole thing takes place over. And since I'm not necessarily familiar with the characters, sometimes groups of people are doing stuff and I have to, like, sit there and just kind of, like, squint my eyes and, like, furrow my brow and be like, are you cops, homeless, or, like, crime syndicate?
Right, exactly. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're all driving towards the same purpose, but you don't know, you know, where they fit in the relation to the other characters until by the end of the film. I think on repeat viewings, that's easier because you're just supposed to take them as a mob.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's all it is. Through the whole film, it's just everybody's against this guy. And building up this character, I mean, Peter Lorre is a weird guy.
Yeah.
You know, we considered doing the recasting of this. But it's just Steve Buscemi. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
it is.
That's what would just happen. I mean, in fact, no matter what troupe we picked, we could go Coen Brothers, we could go Rodriguez, we could go Quentin Tarantino. It would always just be Steve Buscemi.
Go Adam Sandler.
Yeah, no, let's not do that.
Okay.
And the way they build up Peter Lorre's character, I mean, beyond the fabulous job that he does, because I want to, you know, put that out there. I don't want to make it sound like it's all writing work that went into this. He plays a great part, and that's why I got picked up doing a similar part over and over again. But, you know, the film's notable for having literally no score. The only time you hear music is in the Hall of the Mountain King, the little thing that he whistles. Well, Peter Lorre doesn't whistle it because Peter Lorre can't whistle, I found out.
Oh, really?
So Fritz Lang whistled it, which is amusing. But, you know, it's really notable because otherwise it's pretty silent. I would say it's silent to the point that, you know, when you're watching it for the first time, it's almost jarring.
Yeah.
Because there are significant portions where you feel like you're watching a silent film.
Yeah, there's the scene, a bunch of the, like, far away scenes mm-hmm. when it shows, like, the whole street. And
right,
you
any
feel
of the
like
wide
there should
shots.
There should be, like, an overwhelming, like, score swell or, right. like, whistles and shouting. It just it goes silent.
Well, and that's because Foley wasn't a big thing right. back then. I mean, this is 1931. You know, when you want to talk about sound in a production, we've had sound since the early 20s, but I think it was Steamboat Willie from, what, like 1928 that mm-hmm. was the first thing to combine dialogue, to combine sound effects, to combine, you know, an orchestra or at least some kind of soundtrack. So this is only coming 3 years later in a totally different country, and it's just now building all of these different components to create the soundscape of this movie.
Right.
So part of it is an accident that it's so goddamn quiet. And, you know, that's a really effective in parts and not very effective in other parts. We've certainly learned from watching things like this, you know, applause for humanity. We've learned since the 1930s what to do with sound.
Right.
But one of the things I think they get absolutely right is that they have the tune whistled over and over. They have in the Hall of the Mountain King. And that kind of lets you know anytime Peter Lorre's character is around.
Yeah.
A lot of people will argue that that's his transformation into becoming a monster is when he starts humming this, you know, frantically.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see that.
And it's also a song that's been used a billion times since then, which I think is, you know, if you want to talk about lack of innovation, every time summer movies come out, people are like, oh, ew, remakes. Oh, people, Hollywood's forgotten, whatever.
Equals robots.
Here we have like the first fucking movie ever with sound, and we're still using the same goddamn song to build tension today. You know what I mean? But this is also one of the first occurrences, and I think this film is definitely notable for this, where you have a reoccurring theme for a character. You know, this is, and here he's whistling it. So there's a pragmatic reason right. for that. But that's something that was borrowed like from opera and theater, right. where more specifically opera, because you don't have a lot of music in theater. But, you know, you see something like, just think about Lost today. You know, Locke has a theme, Kate has a theme. All the characters have central themes that you hear. That wasn't really established, you know, until back in the 30s when M was one of the first things to do that. So I think it's clearly innovative mm-hmm. for that purpose.
The whistling of this criminal who may or may not be insane.
Right.
And I mean, okay, well, let's get into that.
Well, just the criminal yeah. element too. You know, it's weird to have this kind of, they almost make a joke about it, but I remember the scene in the beginning where, you know, there's a killer on the loose and it's showing a lot of this movie's the town's reaction. You know, I think we've clearly hit on mm-hmm. that. But there's the one guy, he's just talking to the little girl. You know, there's a little girl walking along and instantly the town surrounds him and is like, you pedophile, you murderer, you know. I thought that was funny because I can view that from a point of view where I'm thinking in a 30s mentality of like, oh, what a shocking thing for them to be so like afraid of this killer right. that's about to do that. But if you go outside today and, you know, we live in Chicago, but I think this is pretty universal, at least in the States. If you see a girl just walking down the sidewalk and you stop her and you're like, oh, hey, that's a nice lollipop you have. Yeah. Six cops will surround yep. you and beat you to the ground. Mm-hmm. But sorry, you were talking about capturing yeah. the killer.
So he's in this basement and there's a dirt floor and mm-hmm. there's, you know, a peanut gallery of rabble-rabblers.
Yeah.
And then like a ragtag tribunal, or is there five guy? I don't know. Doesn't fucking matter.
Yeah.
He gets assigned a really good lawyer.
Yeah.
And they just accuse him. Yeah. Like this crime syndicate goes mob justice style.
Right.
And they're like, you know, the world up there won't see it the way that we believe it. You're right. a child murderer and anyone who kills a child deserves death.
Right. It's this cynical idea about the legal system.
Right.
Right. That the legal system won't take care of, that they'll let him off mm-hmm. for whatever reason.
For insanity is the main argument.
Right. And, because apparently back then, the only thing we convicted people of was still pot.
Yeah.
Good to see that's changed.
And there's this insanity thing. And I don't know. Have you seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's this insanity.
I'm glad you go to that one.
I'm thinking of that right here. Right now, I'm just in my mind. I'm doing okay. Everybody, just calm down for a second. We're gonna go into a thought experiment.
Yes, I knew it was about thought experiments.
So in the 30s, there's this film called M, and there's a mob mentality that he's gonna be taken by the justice system and put into an insane asylum just because he pleads insanity that it's beyond his control.
Absolutely.
So now we're what? 20 years? No. A few years in the future. 20, 30 years in the future.
That would be the 50s, my friend. Keep going.
40 years in the future.
I believe we're 80 years in the future.
50, 60 years in the future.
Please continue.
And the same thing has happened.
Uh-huh.
Eliminate the time jump.
Right.
And now you move to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where some hardened criminal has pled insanity for funsies so that he doesn't have to go to prison. And now he's, you know, living the high life with a bunch of crazies.
Right.
Playing with them, making them yell at him for Scrabble and, sure. and flirting with the nurses.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the crime syndicate ultimately doesn't want to happen.
Right.
Fortunately, in this situation, justice is served, even in this thought experiment.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, justice, quote unquote.
Sure.
In their mentality.
Mob justice.
Yes. Mob justice is served regardless
well,
in this thought experiment.
Sort of serve. Well, they come to a verdict, but the police end up catching them.
Right. Well, the verdict is not as much as they come to a verdict as they just, they start the thing going, we're going to kill this guy.
Right.
Let's make a big charade.
Right.
And, they hire him a lawyer who happens to be really good.
Right.
And he's like, you guys, you're doing the wrong thing. He's insane. It's not his fault. You know, this isn't right to kill him.
I don't know
him.
If I like charade more or funsy defense.
Funsy defense.
I think those are both pretty great. So the big question here is, let's put two things aside right away, because I can't even play this thought experiment without these two things. One, mob mentality is wrong.
Yes.
Right? I can't
well,
even...
Well, yeah. I thought that went without saying.
Okay. Well, you know, sometimes... I think that's why movies do that. Not M, because we see the eventual point where the cops arrest the entire mob mm-hmm. or whatever at the end, or at least take him away from the mob. But a lot of movies have this vigilante justice thing where it's like, you know, it's appealing to people who have been beaten down by the legal system or feel like they don't get justice. So yeah. movies
well,
as being escapism.
Like, it's a step or two below the superhero.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But in practice, mob mentality is wrong for a bunch of philosophical reasons we're not going to digest right now. The other thing is, I'm pretty sure you're on the same page with me, but I'm not for the death penalty.
Oh yeah, like, not so much.
Even if I know this guy has killed children and I can prove that, I'm pretty certain I'm not morally justified to sentencing him to death.
I don't think, yeah, no.
Even if I'm part of a mob.
Yeah, no matter what.
And
especially
again,
if you're part of a mob, I think is what you meant to say.
And whereas the mob thing is a philosophical argument I don't want to launch into, and I think this is a question of morality and a human code of morals I don't want to talk about. Let's just put both of those aside. And just say mob mentality is okay, and I am okay with the death penalty, because that's a good thing to do in a thought experiment. Let's just throw all that out the window. So the question I want to ask is insanity.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? I mean, is that the point that his lawyer tries to make, and the big crux of their mock trial, really, is that his lawyer's convinced, and Peter Lorre's character tries to convince you, that he cannot control his compulsion mm-hmm. to kill.
Right.
He has to kill. It sickens him, really, mm-hmm. but he has to do it. And he doesn't even, you know, he gets dizzy and passes out when he does it, and he doesn't remember anything. The idea this mob seems to share is that because he has a compulsion to kill, that is the very thing that needs to convict him, because he can't control his actions. Whereas his lawyer... and his lawyer even seeming to be, you know, he's part of the mob, but he even goes, come on, guys, like, how can you think that? He says the exact opposite. He says that the fact that he can't control these actions and he has a compulsion, it means it's out of his control. And so morally, it's weird to talk about morals in that situation, but morally, he's not really responsible for his actions.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're to take his word for it, and I think that's debatable too, that he's not responsible for his urge to kill, is that something that, you know, absolutely means we have to convict him, or that we can under no circumstance convict him?
It falls into the category of the fact that he's definitely dangerous.
Right.
There is no question in this situation that this is a murderer. Action would have to be taken. It's just like the matter is, and this is really where the definitive line is drawn for me, is the mob is bent on revenge.
Right.
And therefore they want conviction and ultimately death. Or let's eliminate the death penalty and just say they want prison.
They
want to
do
time.
They
want to
do
hell.
Something with him where he's never going to do this
right.
thing. Because their concern is that he'll get off.
Yeah, he'll you know, be cured mentally and whatever.
Sure.
I'm having a really hard time like generalizing the situation.
Sure.
Because there are sentences and processes where you don't get parole.
Right.
Like, that's what happens in this
But they're worried he'll be an exception to the rule.
Yeah, exactly. Well, people tend not to be exceptions to the rule.
Sure.
The exceptions to the rule are people who are exceptionally mentally based.
Right.
The
right.
reason you're an exception to the rule is because you've earned it.
Yeah, the experts have looked at you and determined that you were mentally ill and that is past now.
Yeah. I mean, and when you get into insanity and mental illness, it becomes a really gray area.
Right.
But I'm still pretty convinced that people know when you're crazy and when you're
so
not.
So as part of the town, as part of even if you want to say the mob, you would be the person maybe not speaking up, but at least off to the side going, yeah, I don't know about this.
Yeah, well, I would say mental asylum, but like forever.
Right.
Life yeah. in a mental institution.
Sure, sure.
Like regardless, even if he gets better.
Right. You would say that he, not to put words in your mouth, but just to see if I kind of understand your argument. You would say that he should be put away from society, but not as punishment, more as for protection of society.
Protection of society and apparently himself, because
right,
he
sure.
doesn't like doing it.
Sure, right. Right.
You know, like, I think it seems like saying that, it seems like mutual interest
yeah.
would be to put him into yeah. into a facility where neither party will
it
be hurt anymore.
Does. Well, and so one of the brilliant pieces of M, and we haven't seen this on the show since back when we did Insomnia,
mm-hmm.
where we get an... let's just call it an ending that Eric feels good about, which is something rarely in movies that, you know, when you kind of play a thought experiment in a film and you walk through that, usually it ends up on the wrong side of a moral issue because a film is fantasy and that's what films do. But here I'm going, oh no, no matter what they do, it's either mob justice or they're going to let a killer go free or they're going to kill him. There's no way I'm going to be happy with this. But at the last second, the cops bust in.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has his fair trial and that's what happens. And I'm really glad that they actually ended with the cops taking over because I really thought it was going to go to the mob.
Yeah.
And it's one of those smiling points that I can now go back through the film. And when I get to that scene, I'm okay playing the mob thought experiment because I know in the end, the cops get him. And things turn out the way they should.
So in an alternate situation where police justice doesn't quite pull through,
right.
We have Seven.
Although you do get some cops operating outside the books a little
yeah.
bit. You know,
well,
one of the,
outside the books, but within the books, both at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, the literal books. I think the reason that Seven has worked for me, at every point in my life, I watch Seven like once a year.
Uh-huh.
And it always
yeah, totally.
Does something different
sure.
for me. And the one thing it's always done...
Gets better is one thing
well,
it does
yeah.
for me.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely does. The older you get and the more you watch Seven, the more life experience you have, the better Seven gets.
Well, it's not only life experience, but film experience.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if Seven's, like, one of the first three films you see, you're like, oh, yeah, that was pretty good.
Right.
And you start watching other films, and then you watch Seven again, you're like, wow, that was better than all those other films
yeah,
I watched,
exactly,
too.
Exactly, exactly. Well, and, you know, as you watch more films, you encounter that problem where, and I know you and I both talked about having this because we watch so many fucking films,
bye.
That you start to forget what truly great movies are.
Right.
You see films and you're like, that did an interesting thing, or this amused me for this reason, or whatever. And then you go back to something like Seven and you're like, wow, what a fucking powerhouse. The thing that has always stuck with me is that I hate buddy cop movies,
mm-hmm.
and this turns buddy cop on its head, because
absolutely.
At the end of the day, this is a buddy cop film,
yeah,
right?
Well, essentially, yeah, you have the seasoned old-timey vet
who plays it by the books,
who's ready to get out of the business, and,
right?
Well, no, actually, he's the one that doesn't.
Now, he kind of, he...
He's the
yeah.
out, that's one
he
of the...
He cooks the books, is
yeah,
what happens.
That's one, of, the things, is you have this... In the very beginning, it looks like you have this seasoned vet
right.
who's, like, ready to retire, he's seen it all, he's, you know, jaded and sick
sure,
of the business,
sure.
and then you have this new punk kid who's, you know, a little bit, maybe a little bit trigger happy and ready to
right.
dive into the dirty, gritty stuff because
yep.
he wants to change the world.
Absolutely.
And later on, as it goes through, you realize that maybe it's the other way around.
Yeah.
Like, the character personalities are still the same, but you have, you know, the seasoned vet who's been with it so long that he's a little corrupt now.
Yeah.
You know, he sometimes he goes outside the box to get things done, and then you have... You know, Brad Pitt, who is a loose cannon, and that he'll kick a door down if he's
sure,
a little
sure.
if he's a little pissed off.
Right.
But I think that's less police work and more just him being an angry person.
Right, yeah.
But then at the same time, he's more settled down. He's got a wife, a
absolutely.
Baby on the way, two
absolutely.
Dogs. You know, he goes home at the end of the day to a life outside of the force.
Right.
And it's like, that's not all he thinks about.
Yeah.
Which in normal buddy cop movies, like, the vet will be like, okay, well, you know, it's time to call it a day. And the young gun will be like, no, let's keep gumshoeing it.
And I think that's one of the things, too, that turns noir on its head. I mean, as a piece of, if you want to consider this neo-noir, which I definitely would,
oh, absolutely.
Seven's where I go for.
Definitively.
Seven and Blade Runner are like the two different things you can kind of
yeah.
do with neo-noir.
Be entertaining or be something that you talk about later.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I would argue that Seven you can also talk about
yeah,
later.
That's true.
Burn. You know, the characters in here aren't your typical noir characters. They take all the sort of archetypes of noir. And they basically play Mr. Potato Head with him.
Yep.
You get him all over the place. You even kind of get Tracy in this weird femme fatale role.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to move into this later in the conversation.
Oh,
but
it fits here.
You have a really weird relationship between Tracy and Somerset.
Yeah.
It's the kind of relationship that almost dares you not to talk about it.
They do this thing where it's really similar to the Brother from Another Planet sex scene, which if you don't remember ever seeing a sex scene in Brother from Another Planet or seeing Brother from Another Planet, you need to watch the film and then listen to last week's show. But they do a really similar thing where you have the femme fatale scene. Mm-hmm. Let's strip it down and call it the scene where she walks in, you know, legs up to her neck. Yeah. I could tell that she had blood in her lips. That kind of thing.
Thank you. You're getting good at this.
Except it's at a diner in New York because it's reality.
Right.
And she walks in and I could tell she had a secret from the moment she walked through that door. And he sits down and she gives him this look and he's like, I knew she trusted me a little bit too much. I could never figure out why. Maybe it's just because I'm a hardened cop and I've seen it all. And she's sitting there and she's just like, you have this scene where you're like, oh no, she's going to like come on to him.
Right.
They're going to like go back home and fuck and add this layer of boredom.
Yeah.
Like,
personally. Right. Thank you.
To
layer of mediocrity and redundancy, yeah, really, that
the
we've
film.
Seen.
But
over
instead,
and over.
Instead, she opened her blood red lips to reveal some of the most heart wrenching news I'd heard
and
all
what
week.
Is that, Michael Kester?
She's pregnant.
Yeah.
If
she's
not,
pregnant and she has no friends.
Yeah.
I think
right,
that's the
exactly.
bigger reveal
well, it's,
here.
It's this thing where she's like, okay, I have a secret. I need to talk to you. Can you? She's asking him for advice, which
right.
in you know, 50 years ago,
right.
she would be asking him to do her a favor.
Yeah,
but the favor is just, you know, advice
right.
instead of,
and terrible advice.
Yeah,
I'd
well,
say
it's,
too.
She's asking him for advice
right.
instead of asking him to go kill her jealous boyfriend.
Right. They're not collecting insurance.
Yeah.
Money.
So there's this thing where she's pregnant and she wants to know whether she should have an abortion. And he's
yeah.
like, I'm Morgan Freeman and I vote for abortion. And
what was that right there that just happened?
You know, Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Reagan, I think that's
Morgan
what that
Reagan.
Was.
Anyway, so Morgan Freeman tells her, Somerset, sorry, yeah. we're not allowed to use actor names anymore,
yeah.
says, you know, I told my wife to have an abortion. It was the right decision, and I regret it every day.
Right.
Basically, which is, ugh, oh my God.
Yeah.
I just came a little bit, but it's like one of the best deliveries of that news.
Yeah.
Because he gives her the advice and then also goes, but, you know, whatever you
whatever.
Want to do.
Yeah. Like, whatever you do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it's bad advice because it's washy. I think it's bad advice. And this, you know, I was going to gloss over this, but I think this does kind of reveal a lot of his character.
Yeah, it does.
Which becomes a big part of the film is the character of these two guys. He's a really cynical guy.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't come off that way. He has the typical noir archetype of cynical
yeah.
cop, but he seems like, you know, the good, trusted, honest cop.
Yeah.
And so you see him give advice like this, and you expect him to land some, you know, Morgan Freeman
yeah.
March of the Penguins advice
right.
on her.
Yeah.
And instead,
don't let
he's
the
like,
egg touch the ice is
right.
what he
yeah,
should say.
Exactly. That is what he should say. But instead, he's like, well, do whatever you want, but here I would advise you. This is the big advice
yeah.
that he gives her. Don't tell him.
Yeah.
Lie to your husband.
Right. Well,
which, fuck him. He wouldn't even understand. He's
yeah.
not married. You
and
know
you
what
have,
I mean?
You have this, like, and this comes into play later for me.
Right.
Is the line right before she gives him the news,
mm-hmm.
like, oh, I would never bring a child into this world.
Yeah.
Like, this is the wrong world to bring a child
right.
into.
Again, cynical guy.
Exactly. It's where you really get, like, that's such a punch in the gut of cynicism right,
right.
there.
Right, yeah.
You're like, this guy so despises this planet that he's a part of
mm-hmm.
that he wouldn't prolong life on it.
Yeah.
If Somerset had the chance, he would children of men it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like, no more kids. Sorry.
Yeah.
Like, this world
We're
is
done.
The wrong world
yeah.
for people to reproduce in.
Which is why I always really love scenes like where he's in the bar talking to Mills and they're basically talking about, you know, their worldviews.
Yeah.
One is very cynical and one is optimistic.
Yeah.
And Brad Pitt literally thinks, look, okay, maybe it really is as bad as you're saying, but you just got to throw everything you've got at it.
Yep.
And that's the only way to
yeah.
go. Rather than sit back and just be like, oh, this sucks. World's going to hell.
Right.
You still have to go out there and make your dent. And I think it's funny too, because then Morgan Freeman throws the very pragmatic thing at him. He goes the practical route and he says, well, do you really think
yeah.
that you, he almost
yeah.
mocks him.
Right.
He's like, oh yeah, you're going to go out there and make a difference.
Yeah.
And Mills is basically like, no, I'm not going to make a difference.
Yeah.
But you know, everybody's just got to throw everything they have at
but
it.
But then you have this, like, this is another punch in the face to the buddy cop thing where Brad Pitt gets really upset and he's like, you want me to agree with you.
Yeah.
A lesser man would be like, you know, you've been through all the ropes,
right.
but I don't agree with you.
Yeah.
I do not.
Yeah.
And that's when you first go, oh, maybe, you know, this isn't going the route of Brad Pitt becoming what Morgan Freeman, like replacing Morgan Freeman as Morgan Freeman kind of falters out. That's where you realize maybe this is instead of, you know, seeing how Morgan Freeman got to how he was, you're realizing that you're kind of seeing a new role being filled.
And in stepping back from the heavier stuff this film brings too, I think there's a lot more subtle things that it does for neo-noir. I mean, it still has a plot point you have, and I've lobbied against this a million times before, and I will continue to do so, but you're not holding your audience's hand.
Right.
This doesn't do the National Treasure thing.
Mm-hmm.
National Treasure obviously is my go-to for that, but we could pick on films all day long where, you know, somebody discovers something and then they tell you what that thing means and go to the next thing. This is a movie where you are following the detectives. You're going to the crime scene with them. You're looking at the evidence the way they do. And then later you're re-examining that evidence. Then you're looking at a picture of that evidence. Then you're hearing the characters talk about the evidence. And if you're uninterested in solving the riddle yourself,
right,
or if you're lazy, fat, and stupid, But then they actually tell you what it means. I think of a lot of these different scenes where they're talking about the quote unquote poetry, or, you know, where they're examining the photographs. And finally, after you've seen it five times and could connect the pieces for yourself, if you haven't done it by then, they go, hey, her eyes are circled. That is probably important. Maybe we should go talk to her. And I really like that it gives you so many opportunities to put this thing together for yourself instead of just you're following along someone who's 10 proverbial leaps ahead of you.
Uh-huh.
The other thing I like about that dynamic is that Mills is, you know, he's a big fan of Cliff's Notes, right?
Yeah, sure.
I'll argue with people about this all the time, but I think that's the way to go. And again, in being realistic, Morgan Freeman is the guy who would be a national treasure. You know what I mean? He's the guy who would go home and he would read every tome ever written on
this. That's because he doesn't have a life to go home to.
Well, and Mills is literally like, look, people are dying. I don't have time for this poetry bullshit.
Right.
I'm going to go pick up Cliff's Notes. And I think that's commendable that the film doesn't scoff at that.
Yeah.
You know, that he thinks Morgan Freeman's character would scoff at it.
Yeah.
But he's still going to pick up Cliff's Notes because that's the efficient way to go on this. I just love how true that stuff is. To get to more of that subtle stuff, I think this is early David Fincher.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have a lot of that really good, you know, the macro shots and the really minimalistic lighting. You know, just the colorization of the film, everything is kind of brown and gray. All of these sets are really gross and, you know, the murders, which we have to get to. But those, I think that builds on the grittiness of that. And even when you get light in this film, it's either outside where it's raining all the goddamn time, or the light is this really like sick green color.
Yeah.
And I think that's another one of those things. That's probably why I first latched onto this film, is that it's just fucking gorgeous.
Yeah, it
is. And I kind of wish that he would return to that look, because I think that just works so well for so many things. You know, the macro stuff and the really shallow depth of field stuff, I know it's technical too, and people hate when we ramble on about technical stuff, but it's another one of the characteristics that sets this thing apart in every way from its predecessors.
Just to go back a little bit to where we were talking about, like, this is the combination of the two things we just talked about. Talk about gorgeous and talk about Morgan Freeman reading tomes.
Yeah.
You have this, what I think we've started to just call the classy montage.
Yeah, that's what that is.
Instead of, you know, 80s power music.
Right.
It's classical music.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, okay, we do have to call it out for being a montage.
Sure, like, it is.
It's a montage. In the library, we're talking.
Yeah.
The library when Morgan Freeman goes to do all his research.
Uh-huh.
There's that, and it keeps randomly clipping back to Brad Pitt playing with his dogs, watching football.
Right. You make it sound like he's portrayed as lazy, but I never really felt like it.
No, I'm just saying that's part of the element. It's just not what I want to talk about. And there's this scene where it's just Morgan Freeman. It's a lot of close-up shots of the books and like him walking through the volumes and volumes of this gorgeous library.
Yeah.
Clips of the security guards playing poker. But like, it doesn't feel like a montage.
Mm-hmm.
Because the time elapsed is so, like, small.
Right.
And they do it in this really, really stylistically pleasing way where they have a central shot. Mm-hmm. And that's Morgan Freeman at the table reading.
Yeah.
And they kind of, like, they do a 360 around him really slowly. And they cut away from it to show him walking through the aisles.
Sure.
You know, flipping.
You're kind of panning across his face, and then you're getting him wandering around for
flipping
more books,
through the books, you know, and then it cuts back to the rotation around him at the table. It, like, it, the 360, fuck symbolism, but it's symbolic of, like, that's the knowledge being... It's a knowledge meter for anybody right. who's ever played a boring video game. It's kind of like in Final Fantasy VII when you're trying to get your fucking limit break up. No, yeah. I deferred from boring video
sure,
game.
Sure.
But it's like you're trying to get meter, your limit right. break up. By the time you get all the way around Morgan Freeman's head,
right.
you can do Maelstrom and kill Sephiroth. But yeah, it's just this really well put together. It doesn't feel like a montage.
I think, again, that's credit to David Fincher's directing style. Yeah,
and it's not as painful
style.
As a montage.
Oh, right.
And you feel like, you
well,
know.
Well, aside of just being gorgeous, a lot of these techniques he's using help build certain elements of the film. You know, I can watch a film just because it's aesthetically pleasing art. I mean, I've been a designer for like a decade, and that's just something mm-hmm. I'm kind of attracted to. When you get something like the macro shots or the lighting or the way he can juxtapose this footage together and make it not feel like a montage, that helps execute that scene that he wanted to portray, but not make it a cheesy eye-rolling scene. I mean, that's important to the pacing and the mood of this thing. Also, this grittiness that he's building really helps when you see the kills.
So there's this thing where there's 7 kills, blah, blah, blah. Don't need to get into that right now. We'll touch on that in a little bit. But there's the gross ones,
uh-huh.
the really, really upsetting. There's the fat guy, which
right.
that's a set that I would love to have in my kitchen.
Yeah.
Like at my dining room table, just have a big clay fat man
think you're
sleeping
alone
in his
on that
SpaghettiOs.
One, and that's a powerful one to start
it is.
With.
It I is.
Mean, you want to talk iconic?
Well, because it hits you in the face. It's huge.
That's it. Yeah, well, maybe that's it.
And then you have one of the scariest moments in film history, which yeah. is the sloth one.
Yeah, literally the history of cinema. It's fucking terrifying.
And then there's the lust one, which just like that blows my mind every time, just right. considering it. I mean, I've had qualms. Like I would turn around and start slashing at him with my dick, but that's neither here nor there.
Sure.
But let's get to the two kills that they breeze over
right.
so that we can cover something that people don't cover. You have Greed, which is the lawyer.
Uh-huh.
Who has to cut off a pound of flesh, no more, no less, not cartilage nor bone, but only flesh.
Right.
And then Pride, which is the supermodel.
Yeah.
These are my two favorite kills, mostly because they're the ones that make me go, what would I do?
Yeah, sure.
Like,
they make you play the thought experiment.
Yeah, and they're
one of the most interesting things
like,
the film can do.
I don't identify with eating too much spaghetti. I don't right. identify with being a heroin drug dealer. You know, I don't identify.
But you do identify with the legal system and looking beautiful.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Well, no, I mean, it's instead of really directly identifying with the type of person it mm-hmm. is, it's just a thing that happened and
right.
it's made doubly effective by the type of person.
Right.
They're being punished more for what they are and less by what they are.
Right.
You get what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have this lawyer who, like, what do you cut off?
Yeah.
You know, you sit there and you go, I would cut off my thigh.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, the first thing you go, oh, yeah, like around the stomach area
sure.
probably, but that fucking killed him.
Yeah.
That's the wrong move.
Yeah.
And it seems like a simple situation for the supermodel one, but at the same time, maybe not. I mean, I see how people look at weird people.
Right.
I live in Chicago.
Right, yeah.
You know, like,
you
maybe
look
that's
at weird people.
That's
so.
That's not something. Maybe that's not something that I could even put up with. Let alone somebody who's made their living and life based on it.
Sure.
And it makes sense. And that's when it becomes like reality. Like there are people. Maybe that this killer is onto something.
Right.
Like, you know, not in the respect. Like I appreciate you for slaughtering
sure.
these horrible things. It makes you step back and go, this isn't too far off.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this like whole situation where like you go, if given the catalyst of a self-righteous, God-loving motherfucker
right.
like Kevin Spacey,
right.
this might actually happen.
To mention that sort of vanity kill too, I mean, not to go too deep,
yeah.
but you're talking about someone who makes their profession as a model.
Right.
You know, it's cutting off a guitar player's hands.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Right.
He makes it such an easy, superficial thing as, oh, she won't be beautiful anymore.
Yeah.
But it's asking her to change everything at her core being, for better or for worse,
well,
that she's become.
And no, I mean, not knocking like models or anything, but like, what is your skill set?
Right. Well, yeah.
She's
yeah.
gone this far down this road, and your skill set, when your skill set is your beauty, it becomes difficult once that's taken away from you
right.
in a really horrific fashion.
There's so much to say about this film that
yeah,
we've gone this far into it and just now are mentioning Kevin Spacey,
mm-hmm.
but this was back during the golden age, if you will, of Kevin Spacey. And it's amazing because you build this guy up this whole time. I mean, he's from the opening 9 Inch Nails, you know, closer.
Yeah.
I think that's the precursor mix.
Yeah.
But from the opening 9 Inch Nails credit sequence, you know, where you first see his hands and what he's doing, you don't really see much of him. Again, to go back to M, you know, in the way we're doing that.
Right.
When you do see him, you know, as Somerset says, like, even if he turns out to be fucking Satan himself, you're going to be sorely disappointed.
Yep.
And later on, once he's turned himself in, he makes that great quote about, you know, if John Doe's head cracks open and a UFO flies out, I want you to be prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. This is the definitive movie for It's Just a Guy.
Yep.
It's something we've hit on over and over on our show. It doesn't matter. It's just a guy, you know? And I think one of the things that kind of you can have your cake and eat it too here is not only is it just some guy that you've never really seen, you kind of ran into once, but it's not like it's not the president. It doesn't turn out to be the head of this company. It's just some guy. But when they reveal some guy, they've set themselves up so they can just have it be a boring, plain, stupid fucking character.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know, for all intents and purposes, what it should be. But it's not. This guy's great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Kevin Spacey as the killer is one of my most memorable killers in literally anything I've ever seen.
Sure. Like like a few tiers below Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, I would say he's right up there with Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy, and a lot of it is because you've been following his body of work, but you would expect that when you meet the guy, he's no big deal.
You're bored.
But
you're
for some
disappointed,
reason. Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Satan himself, but, you know, bring on Kevin Spacey.
And among a large list of things that Kevin Spacey's character does that we won't get to talk about because we don't have fucking time, he has this great conversation with Mills and Somerset in the car as they're driving to the last.
It's the only conversation. You have a film that's gone two and a half hours? Or
whatever.
An hour and a half.
9 hours.
Sorry. It's gone 16 hours without seeing Kevin Spacey. You bring this character in the last leg of the film, and you're not like, who is
this
guy?
You're not uncomfortable with him.
You're like, you're like, yeah, he's been here the whole time.
Yeah, you really
this is the guy.
Like that. You really do feel like that.
Like, and you're not uncomfortable. You don't really feel like you need to get to know them to like really identify with the killer. Like, you know, and as long as he fills the shoes, you're like, this is it. This is what's going on. Like,
man, and that's another one of these elements that this movie is the antithesis of just fucking everything I hate. And you know, I've rallied against Saw before, and we'll get into Saw more when we actually do them on the show, because whatever, I'm going to take that plunge and we'll see how that goes. But these seem like movies that people enjoy, movies of this breed, this Saw breed, because they haven't seen Seven.
Mm-hmm.
They have not seen this movie that has the nuance in its characters, this movie that is, I would argue, visually more pleasing, and as far as the element of grit is far more disturbing than a lot of these films. One where the twist of the character is such a fucking afterthought and doesn't even, you know, this is a movie where we were both fearful watching it because you do see Kevin Spacey once before in the film. And it's just to play off his relationship with the cops, not because it's a big twist at the end. Not because it turns out he's the doctor or the fucking man laying on the floor, but because, you know, we wanted to see how he's been playing off these cops. And I was afraid they would go back and hand feed us. In my memory, I've seen so many shitty films that they're going to go back and show us when he took the picture and whatever.
Right.
But it breezes over that. You know, we understand that that's where he's from. And unlike these bastard children that it has spawned off, I think this movie does it gives its audience so much more credit than the bullshit that's being churned out.
Right.
When we finally get to the ending, I feel like it gives us a lot to tackle.
Okay, so this whole ending winds down, or winds up, really.
Yeah, I think the tension, definitely.
There's two
the
bodies.
The score helps spell that. We didn't mention the score, but the score in this, I think, is really fantastic, too. It's really brooding and makes the film feel really like an individual.
You get to this point where there's two bodies, and, you know, I'm going to let you guys cook on that, cook on the two bodies question, because that's just more fun on your own.
Right.
It'd be horrible to spell that out. But there's two bodies, and there's two sins left, which means there has to be two more murderers.
Yeah.
And
in
Kevin
some
Spacey's
combination of the three of them, we will find two bodies and two sins.
And so you run out into the middle of the fucking desert. You get this big reveal with Brad Pitt's wife.
Yeah.
And you finally get it spelled out for you by the killer, because that's who would spell it out. Because he's got James Bond in the laser, like the laser rack. And
it's
time to reveal the master plan.
Well, and it's funny, too, because this is one of the, you know, Kevin Spacey's in a lot of the movies that have the infamous spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we make the Bruce Willis joke all the time, but I think we could just as easily do the Gwyneth Paltrow's head in the box is where I was going to go with that.
Oh, that too.
You know, but it's weird because if you reveal that twist, I don't think that, you know, it ruins the climactic ending, sort of, the big reveal there, but the movie is still, I mean, 98 point whatever fucking bullshit percentage. It's amazing. It's still great.
Totally.
I don't think it really diminishes the movie at all. But once you get to that point, you have to decide, split-second decision, what do you do about this?
Yeah.
And there's a million different endings for this movie, but I'm kind of curious what our conclusion is here, what it says about these big dynamic character arcs we blabbered on and on about.
Well, you have essentially what the film does, what the film ending is chosen. You have Somerset running to bring peace to the situation. Like, don't do it. Give me your gun. You know, John Doe has the upper hand now. Yeah.
And the execution of this whole thing is just, I mean, every single one of those lines, you know, it's hairs on the back of my neck. John Doe has the upper hand. Brad Pitt's infamous,
like, what's in the box? Come on. Yeah, what's in the box?
Seriously. And you can just, that scene just gets recreated in my head. You just mention one of those lines and I have to play out the entire scenario.
The part
again.
Of that scene, honestly, that kind of churns my stomach is you have Morgan Freeman, like, exclaiming, you have the seasoned veteran cop exclaiming that the criminal has gotten the best of him.
Right.
You have Brad Pitt on the brink of tears screaming, is my wife's head in the box?
Yeah.
And over all of it, you calmly have Kevin Spacey being like, become Wrath, David.
Yeah, exactly.
Become Wrath. Just really calmly. Right. Like, isn't this just so sad?
And so he fucking shoots him.
Yeah.
I mean, in this great moment of, you know, before Brad Pitt became like a movie, before Troy, basically, before Brad Pitt was a joke you put in your films, he has this great moment of just a split second of hesitation before he just fucking caps him like 9 times. And I just love that scene. It's just fantastic. And so in doing that, he has given in to, basically at the end of the day, even though their character arcs have, you know, gone down a bunch of different paths, they've ended about where you think they're going to.
Yep, pretty much.
I mean, you get Morgan Freeman's character, you get Somerset basically trying to stand up
for the
good
situation.
Yeah, and you get Mills giving in, and you get Kevin
Luke
Spacey.
Bannon.
You know, there's a bunch of different alternate endings to this, but I always really like the idea of Somerset shooting Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, that's my favorite too.
You know, Somerset shooting John Doe is a much more, it goes back to all these conversations they've had, these cynical conversations, where he's decided, you know what, against all better judgment. And I talked about this in M, I'm not for capital punishment.
Right.
I would never shoot a person except maybe if my own life was at risk. But as far, you know, as a movie's plot threads go, him shooting John Doe is him finally taking charge and contributing, you know, to the world.
Right.
He's looked at this situation and he said, hey, I need to, you know, I need to finally do something.
Right.
I can't just be, it's even worse than apathetic, right? Because he is apathetic towards people who are apathetic.
Right.
I mean, that's the bar conversation. It's not, oh, I see this town and I just can't care, but he sympathizes with people who are apathetic. I mean, that is the most soulless, empty position you could ever be in. And I think by shooting John Doe in the end, you know, I just like that ending so much better because it's more, first of all, it's more unexpected.
Yeah.
Second of all, I feel like it does something interesting with his character
arc.
The
same thing.
And it gives you a lot of questions as to what's going to happen next.
Yeah. And for me, I think he set himself up as this really cynical, like, the world's gone to hell. There's no reason to, like, people are bad.
Right.
The anti-humanitarian. Like, people are bad.
Yeah.
That's it. Humanism is bullshit.
Right.
And in the car, you kind of, like, when he's talking to John Doe, he's having this conversation, and I like to imagine, like, he's realizing that John Doe is one step.
Sure.
John Doe basically has a little bit more motivation.
Well, and you know,
and he's like John Doe is really the combination of the two characters.
Yeah.
He's totally given up on the fucking planet, but he thinks he can make a difference.
Yeah.
And so I really
he's the worst of the two characters.
And I really like thinking about it as Morgan Freeman pulling the trigger on that side of him.
Sure.
Being like, I was wrong, you know, like, I need to kill that aspect of me. And what better way to do it than physically fucking kill this guy that represents all the bad that I could achieve.
Right. Well, and I think in that conversation in the car they have on the way there, I think that really serves for Somerset to realize that he's only one step away from this character.
Right.
As far, I mean, their end results are different. What they're physically doing is different, but their motivations are the same.
Pretty much.
He's just, you know, John Doe's doing something about the way that Somerset feels.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost feel like the ending is, you know, the worst of all possible endings because it puts everybody in a... Basically, I think what they wanted to do is not let John Doe win. And so the question becomes at the end, are we going to let John Doe win or not? When I feel like this whole time, the question was more about these guys, you know, their different outlooks towards the world and if that's going to change or not. I think we have to wrap this up.
I think so too.
That's unfortunate. There's so fucking much to say about this movie. We have a good one coming up next week.
Yeah, we do.
What is that one?
Death to Smoochie and the King of Kong.
All right, so the King
of Kong... Fistful of Quarters.
Yes, yes. King of Kong's a documentary, and Death to Smoochie is a black comedy, is a dark comedy, and Yeah, I would say definitive for our generation. I think that one always stands out to me. We'll just buzz through this quick. We got a brand new website, doublefeatureshow.com. You can send us your email, doublefeatureshow@gmail.com. Do some other stuff that I always talk about in the outro of the show.
Another thing you should do is watch more fucking film.
And goodbye.